So I want to go back again to World War II Germany. I want to talk about another thing, which is also about bugging out. And that is, you have to recognize when you've got nothing left to lose. And there are a lot of people who stayed in New Orleans despite all the warnings. We saw a lot of those people in the Superdome and in the Memorial Convention Center. And it took me a long time to piece together, you know, why did so many people stay? Well, some of them just couldn't physically leave. I mean, there were, you know, elderly people and sick people. No matter how dire the danger is, if you move them, they're going to die, you know, or they're going to suffer greatly in some way. So you sort of make the best of it. But you should always recognize when you've got nothing else to lose. And the easiest example of that is your house is on fire. You need to get out. This is not optional. This is not, oh, maybe this room won't burn. And in any combination of disasters, you need to be able to clearly recognize that event. When you look at something, you know, for me it was, you know, oh, there's Category 5 storm, you know, if you draw the line, it passes, you know, pretty much right through my house. We've got nothing left to lose at this point. We're leaving. Conversely, if you're standing on the train platform and they're putting you on the train for Auschwitz, you've got nothing left to lose. And one of the poverties that the Jews experienced on the train platform is the same poverty that a lot of people in the Superdome and the Memorial Convention Center experienced. And that is that they were all individuals in a sea of individuals. In other words, they were it. That was all they had. They didn't look around them and see other people in the same situation. They were just seeing themselves, and they were saying, oh, what can I do? Okay, well, you know, in the beginning I said, you know, your fingers are your tactics, and if you make a fist, that's a strategy. Sometimes you have to get down to the objective. And so one of the answers that I've never heard, mostly, I suppose, because it was illegal, was I've never heard any of the Jews tell me I had a gun in my suitcase. And whenever you look at the Red Cross preparedness manuals, they're pretty good, and you look at any of the government documentation, a lot of the churches now have put together some documentation on, you know, emergency preparedness. None of them list firearms. And I think that there's a hole there, not, of course, among the preparedness savvy, but that's a message I hope to transmit on the blog a little bit later, that, you know, how important that becomes.
Yeah, I remember during Katrina, some friends and I were talking about how the police were going around and disarming people who were just trying to protect their homes. And I remember briefly seeing one, I believe it was a CNN clip, where the lady, they took her pistol away from her, and she's like, how am I going to protect my home now? And they told her, well, now you have to leave.
Yeah, and the most famous one is Patricia, which is the older lady that the California Highway Patrol tackled in her kitchen.
Yes, I remember seeing that clip.
And took away her unloaded revolver from her, which was an H&R 32, I believe. But, I have this conversation a lot, and that's one of the things that, you know, people always want to talk about is, oh, those jackbooted thugs went around and they collected weapons. Yes, they did. And whose fault is that? Whose fault is that really? Whose fault is it that California Highway Patrol tackled Patricia in her kitchen?
My guess would be the chief of police and mayor of New Orleans, because they're the ones who issued the order.
But where were all of Patricia's neighbors? Where was Patricia's tribe to say, Patricia Connie belongs to us, and we're all good here. Thank you very much for your concern. Because that's what we had in my neighborhood, you know, after the fact. You know, we had a bunch of guys, and I'm not going to say that, you know, we ran around shooting everybody, but we had our own security, you know, and the police would actually come here because we were a safe area, and, you know, if they needed something to drink, or needed to get the bathroom, whatever, they came, you know, inside of our roadblocks. And it always strikes me, you know, that, you know, what happened to Patricia was pretty bad, and you know, the cops who did it to her, you know, something should happen. There are some lawsuits that are going on. I try to follow the case as best I can. There's, you don't find too much about it in the media. You know, that's obviously wrong. But there's also a disconnect between what the cops want to do and what the civilians allow. You know, and if we're all standing in the street going, yeah, we're great here, you know, need anything, let us know. But Patricia belongs to us, and you can't take her. Then that speaks to something.
Well, part of that, what I think you're saying is the sense of community, and the community was not there for her. Am I getting that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And community is one of those things that I guess we haven't talked about too much in it. And that I've sort of left for later on in the blog, because I do talk about community and then the things that we did. And I see somebody on the blog there just put up,
yeah, how do you convince your neighbors before the fact?
There is no good answer for that, because it depends on your neighbors.
With my neighbors that I have where I live, I've got Jim and his wife and everybody else on one side, then I've got John on the other. I know that at any time, if I had issues, I could count on them to help me with those issues. Because, you know, good neighbors, you know, like they always use the old saying, a good fence builds good neighbors. And we don't have a fence, but, you know, we are good neighbors. You know, we borrow stuff back and forth. We loan things back and forth. We talk. In fact, Jim told me, you know, where his location of his property, in case something happened, they had to pull out. And he told, you know, he let me know where his property was in case we ever had to go there. And my other neighbor, John, you know, it all depends. You have to build a rapport with the members of your community and your neighbors.
That's true, and that's really not something you can do overnight. And I know I'm beating this analogy to death, but if we go stand on that train platform in 1941 and 1942, we have a very large crowd of people that is not a community. And I can take you right now, and we're 3 years now after Katrina, and I can show you dead neighborhoods. And not all of those neighborhoods flooded. And they're dead neighborhoods because they failed to establish any kind of community. And how do you do that before something happens? Well, it's hard. It takes a long time. You know, you've got to go, you know, when you take out the trash and you see the neighbor, you don't just wave and go back inside. You wave and you go over and you say, hey, how's it going? You know, how's the kid?
Well, I've got neighbors across the street. I mean, Sue and his wife, I mean, after I hurt, I've had back surgery, I hurt my back last year, and I couldn't, you know, cut my grass properly. Sue and his wife came over and were more than happy to help me out. The people people directly across the street from me. Heck, they're over here, their son's over here at my house so often, I consider him to be one of my kids. I mean, what you're saying is that you have to make an effort to go out and get to know everybody around you and be known by them. Otherwise, you're going to have a breakdown if something does happen.
Right. You're building a kind of wealth. And I guess we could call that wealth community.
A good friendship, good neighbors, that I would consider that to be part of wealth.
The other half of that is after something happens, the people who are mentally capable of taking, of handling whatever situation it is, you just need to sort of do it. And it's sort of your job to take care of everybody else. And the best example of that is that, you know, everybody has a different skill, okay? We had Miss Mary in our neighborhood, and she cooked. She cooked for everybody. And we started bringing food over, and she would cook, and we'd go eat, you know, and that was her skill, you know. The woman was never going to pick up a rifle. Well, that wasn't her job, okay? And you can't expect everybody to be on the same page with you as far as preps go. But after the fact, everybody's going to have some skill. Now, some people are just going to be lazy, or they're going to be in shock, or something else. But you have to maintain that community, even with the people who you're sort of dragging along this dead weight in some ways, because later on, you're going to need those people. You know, and the way to think about that is
emotional support.
Sure. I mean, and my brother-in-law, Jeff, you know, one of the things he said after the storm was he went back to his neighborhood. His house was completely destroyed, and so were all the houses in the neighborhood. And they all wound up, parked in FEMA trailers in their muddy lots. I asked him one time, I said, dude, why don't you just get out of there? And he says, no, he says, I can't leave the neighbors. He says, I don't really want to talk to anybody who, you know, hasn't been through what I've been through. And so that was sort of his coping mechanism. You know, I looked at it as, you know, I'd get the heck out of here. But what he was telling me was, you know, this is all the emotional wealth I have left. You know, I can't just abandon it. You know, and for some of those neighborhoods, it's a hard fight. You know, I'm happy to say that his neighborhood seems like, you know, they're going to survive and they're going to come back. But even in his neighborhood, there are just some people who, you know, they have certain skills, but they don't have others. You know, and, you know, there are going to be, you know, some of your neighbors who can pick up a rifle. There are going to be some of your neighbors who can't. There are going to be some neighbors who are going to cook. You're going to find that some people are going to find their role and they're going to stick with it. You know, we had one of the teenagers in the neighborhood, and he was the water boy. You know, he was the one who went around and made sure that everybody had clean water and, you know, here's something to drink and, you know, do you need anything else? And that was actually very helpful, you know, because you're working, you're trying to, you know, clear debris out of your yard, you're trying to get your house patched up, and you're not thinking all the time about, gee, you know, I'm really thirsty, maybe I should stop for a minute, you know, I quit sweating 20 minutes ago, you know, but here he would come around, you know, every so often, you know, hey, you know, you want something cold to drink? That was very valuable.
Part of it was the actual physical necessity of needing water, the other part of it was he was sort of, I guess you would say, an emotional disconnect to make you step back and appreciate what you still had.
Sure.
And he was looking out for your best interest as well.
You know, post any kind of disaster, you know, you said, you know, you've got food preps and you've got water preps and, you know, you've got guns in the house and, you know, so you're sort of taking that global approach. There are going to be other people who just don't have it. They don't have a global approach, but they're going to have something. You know, they're going to have something to contribute. In my particular neighborhood, there's a man named Mr. Bonin, and that's not his real name, but that's the name I've used for him on the internet, so that's the name we'll keep using. He's a World War II veteran, and I came back into the neighborhood a few days later, and there was Bonin marching up and down the street in his World War II uniform, looked very dashing, with his M1 carbine. And I was sort of taken aback by that, but, you know, as soon as we started getting people in the neighborhood, Bonin just started giving orders. It wasn't, hey, let's have a committee and let's get a neighborhood meeting going and let's, you know, decide what method we're going to use to move forward. No, it was none of that. It was like, all right, well, Bonin told us to do this, so we're going to do it. And those people who didn't find their own role wound up having their role selected for them. You know, it's like, okay, well, you guys do this. That didn't last too long because we wound up so well coordinated that, you know, we got back to normal fairly quickly. And so I'm going to come to that point in the blog where I start to stress that to folks who, you know, those of us who are mentally prepared might need to think for a lot of the rest of the people. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we're going to put together our own kingdom, but we need to do the things that make sure that our towns run, you know, so that we've got some community going.
Okay, so what you're saying is there are going to be some people who are better prepared, not prep-wise, but better prepared mentally for leading the community, basically, back into the rebuilding. And some people will have it forced upon them. Others will just step up and do it.
Right.
Is that about what you're saying?
Yeah, and I mean, well, let's face it. Most of the people who are physically prepped are going to be mentally prepped. Because the reason they're prepped is because they've thought about it. And you know, in thinking about it, you sort of inoculate yourself to that eventuality. That, you know, some opportunity is going to arise, and it's going to be, you know, ugly in the middle, but we have to have some kind of an objective and some kind of a strategy so that we go forward as a community. And I, in the blog, I sort of rag on the individualistic idea, you know, oh, well, you know, I've got all my preps, and, you know, if you didn't make your preps, well, that's just too bad. Well, individualism doesn't work. You know, there's a lot of folks who tried that after Katrina, you know, and they didn't have the support system mentally, physically, emotionally, or spiritually to accomplish what they needed to accomplish post-Katrina. You know, you can have all of your preps, but, you know, food is not going to find you a job. Water is not going to fix your roof. You know, guns aren't going to, you know, find you a place to stay. And I say this, but there's safety and security are not the same thing. And a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that they're equivalent. I can be safe in my bed at night only if I'm secure.
Well, you can be safe in a encampment that the government puts together where they feed you three, you know, you get three squares a day in a cot, and but you can't go anywhere, you can't do anything, you have no freedom to move, you can't go see your property or anything else, and all your security is to the armed guards walking around the outside of it.
That's it. And unless you take, in some cases, drastic measures to ensure your own safety and security, you know, you're not going to survive. You know, and I've had a lot of discussions now with people online, and, you know, like one of the things we did after Katrina is we blocked the end of the street. It was actually already blocked when I got here, but, you know, I thought it was a pretty good idea. You know, people are like, how can you block a public roadway? You know, your rights end at your driveway. You know, you don't have any rights in the street. And my answer to that is that